Today is our Meter Center Fall Lecture. My name is Karine Mogg. I am the director of the Meter Center for Calvin Studies. And just in case some of you may not be familiar what the Meter Center is, particularly among the students, the Meter Center is a research center and a special collection focusing on John Calvin, Calvinism, and the Reformation. So anything to do with the Reformation, we are the place to come. And we're located right up here in the library. You will find us. So come and visit us if you're ever working on any project related to the Reformation. We are definitely the place to come. Today we welcome our lecturer, Dr. Yuda Tianto. He is our fall lecturer today. He is a professor of theology and chair of the Department of Theology and Church and Ministry Leadership at Trinity Christian College in Illinois. He has worked there since 2001. He obtained his PhD from Calvin Theological Seminary, so in some ways he's coming home, which is great. And he did his undergraduate degree in Indonesia, which is his country of origin. Dr. Tianto's research interests have spanned a wide range of topics, from controversies over the theology of baptism in 17th century England, to his current work on the reception of the Reformed faith in Indonesia. His interests outside the world of scholarship include gardening and music. He is an organist, a pianist, and a fine singer, and I can testify to this because we sang in the same choir for many years. His topic for us today is the tradition of singing metrical psalms and ecclesiastical songs in the Dutch East Indies in the early 17th century. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Yuda Tianto.
Thank you, Karine. Thank you for the generous introduction, and thank you for inviting me to this lecture today. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this lecture. Before I read my paper, I'll just show you a few maps to give you some orientation of the Southeast Asia and the Dutch East Indies and the country of Indonesia. So this is the map of the East Indies, the way the Dutch and the Portuguese and the Spaniards knew in the 16th and 17th centuries. The center of attraction is in this part of the archipelago called the Moluccas Islands. The city of Ambon, if you are familiar with the name, is right on this island, also called the island of Ambon. Another town that, I will talk about today is Batavia, which became the center of the government of the Dutch later on. So that's the 16th century map, and this is a more focused map of the archipelago, the Moluccas Islands, where the spices grew the best of all Southeast Asia, and that's why the Europeans were over there. And this is now the map of the country of Indonesia. All right, now here's my paper. The Dutch first came to the East Indies at the end of the 16th century, while more than 50 years behind their Iberian rivals in setting their feet in the archipelago, the Dutch soon gained firm power in the monopoly of spice trading in Southeast Asia due to the establishment of the Dutch East India Company, the famous Verenigde Oost-Indische Company, or the VOC for short. While establishing their power, the Dutch also introduced Reformed Protestantism to the indigenous people in the archipelago. They soon published catechetical materials and translated parts of the Bible into Malay, one lingua franca of the region. The theology and ecclesiastical practices of these new churches were largely shaped by the decision of the Synod of Dort of 1618-1619. In 1624, the ministers who were sent to the East Indies worked together to draft the Batavische Kerken Ordening, or the Church Order of Batavia, to provide guidance and direction of how they should conduct worship in the newly established churches. When the Church Order of Batavia was revised in 1643 to further address the issues that specifically arose in Java, it became more apparent that the theology and ecclesial practices of Reformed Protestantism that was the result of Calvin's Reformation in Geneva occupied a strong place in the archipelago. The Church Order of Batavia emphasized that preaching, the singing of the psalm, instruction of school children and catechism should be done in the vernacular. This naturally led to the need to translate the Bible, the Psalms, and the catechism books into Malay. The first Malay translation of the Gospel of Matthew was published by a copeman or a merchant of the VOC by the name of Albertus Ruel in 1629. This is the title page of the translation of the Gospel of Matthew into Malay. Less than a decade later, Ruel also published the Malay translation of the Gospels of Matthew and Mark together in 1638. Following the text of these Malay translations of the Gospels was a small collection of one Genevan psalm and other ecclesiastical songs also translated into Malay in metrical form. The inclusion of the ecclesiastical songs and the psalm in the publication of the Malay translations of the Gospels showed the Dutch's strong efforts to bring Reformed Protestantism to the people of the East Indies. Thus, this collection of songs became a means for us to see the migration of religious ideas brought by the Dutch to the Malay-speaking people in the archipelago. By looking at the texts of the metrical psalms and the ecclesiastical songs translated and transplanted in the East Indies, this paper attempts to reveal the continuity and the discontinuity of the tradition of singing in the Reformed churches internationally, starting with Calvin's Reformation in Geneva through the Netherlands to the East Indies. So now first, let's look at briefly the tradition of singing the metrical psalms in Geneva. Singing the psalms was one significant element in the worship of the Reformed churches since the time of Calvin. In Geneva, Calvin insisted that the church only sang, with the exception of very limited number of biblical songs, the psalms. Calvin believed that there is no better song with which humans can praise God other than the Psalms. He expressed his thoughts regarding singing as follows. Here I quote from Calvin. "Moreover, since the glory of God ought in a measure to shine in the several parts of our bodies, it is especially fitting that the tongue has been assigned and destined for this task, both through singing and through speaking. For it was peculiarly created to tell and proclaim the praise of God. But the chief use of the tongue is in public prayers, which are offered in the assembly of believers, by which it comes about that with one common voice, as it were with the same mouth, we all glorify God together, worshiping Him with one spirit and in the same flesh." End quote. The Genevan church sang the Psalms in unison. This practice could have been the practical application of what Calvin thought singing in the church should be. For him, singing in worship was closely associated with the heart's affection in thinking about God. He wrote this in the Institutes, and here I quote, "Yet we do not here condemn speaking and singing, but rather strongly commend them, provided they are associated with the heart's affection. For thus do they exercise the mind in thinking of God and in keeping it attentive," end quote. Calvin warned the people that the words through which we praise God and pray to Him are much more important than the melody. And thus, here Calvin again, "We should be very careful that our ears be not more attentive to the melody than our minds to the spiritual meanings of the words," end quote. He strongly believed that when people understand this basic principle of singing and praising God well, singing becomes the most holy and salutary practice. He also reminded people that songs that are composed only for sweetness and delight of the ear are unsuitable to the majesty of the church and the most displeasing act before God. The tradition of singing metrical psalms flourished under Calvin's leadership. Scholars agree that the efforts to compose metrical psalms were one of Calvin's earliest contributions in reforming worship in the Church of Geneva. Ever since the time when he ministered in Strasbourg, Calvin had insisted that the church's necessity to sing the metrical psalms. While in exile in Strasbourg, he published the first Psalter in 1539. This Psalter was a collection of 22 texts by Clement Marot and Calvin himself. The tunes were taken from German Psalters. As soon as he returned to Geneva, he published the first edition of the Genevan Psalter in 1542. This little book is a collection of 39 metrical psalms, which were mostly composed by Clement Marot. Calvin's view of the significance of singing the Psalms, or ecclesiastical songs as he called it, was expressed in the Ecclesiastical Ordinances of the Church of Geneva, published in 1541, in which he insisted that, and here I quote again, it will be desirable to introduce ecclesiastical songs in order to better incite the people to prayer and to the praise of God. See how prayer and praise of God are linked together. To begin with, the little children shall be taught, and then in course of time, the whole church will be able to follow, end quote. Over the next 2 decades, the Reformed Church in Geneva saw a few more editions of the Psalter. The publications of metrical psalms were enriched by the arrival of Louis Bourgeois, who was appointed the music educator of the Reformed Church in Geneva in 1542. Bourgeois was employed to write metrical psalms to add to the ones that were already published. The complete Genevan Psalter was finally published in 1562, only 2 years before Calvin's death. This book had 152 texts, one for each psalm, the Ten Commandments, and the Song of Simeon. The psalms were set in 125 different tunes, so there are some tunes that are used double for a couple of different psalms. The function of the metrical psalms in the liturgical context of the Reformed Church in Geneva, according to John Whitfield, was the greatest irony of the Genevan Psalters. Whitfield comments that unlike the Roman Catholic psalmody, the texts of the metrical psalms were not directly taken from the Bible. The metrical psalms were poetic versification in metrical form. The reason for this, Whitfield writes, was pretty straightforward. The psalms needed to be rendered in a singable musical form, and metrical psalmody was judged to be the most singable. Now, let's look at the collection of the psalm and ecclesiastical songs in Malay. Similar approach to Genevan psalm singing was adopted by the Reformed churches in the Netherlands, beginning from the late 16th century onward. In the early 17th century, the Dutch Reformed Church established the Church Order of the Synod of Dort, which, among many other items, regulated the singing of the psalms in the church. As I already mentioned, when the Dutch Reformed ministers established the Reformed churches in the East Indies in the early 17th century, they adopted and adapted the Church Order of the Synod of Dort into the Church Order of Batavia in 1624. The Church Order of Batavia showed a very clear and strong tie between the Reformed churches in Europe and those in the East Indies on worship and theology that were rooted in the Reformed Church of Geneva under the guidance of Calvin. The Dutch taught the Psalms to the people in the East Indies by way of the English method. The church used a leader who would sing to the who would sing the first line of the psalm, with the congregation repeating the same line, and then the leader moved to the second line, and so on. This was called the English method because this way of singing was commonly done in the Church of England. The songs that are included in the collection of the Malay psalm and ecclesiastical songs are the Ten Commandments, the Song of Zechariah set to the tune of Genevan Psalm 137, the Gloria in Excelsis Deo, the song of the angels, set to the tune of Genevan Psalm 80, the Song of Simeon, the Magnificat, the Apostles' Creed, set to the tune of Genevan Psalm 23, the Lord's Prayer, the Apocryphal Psalm 151, a sung prayer for before the sermon, set to the tune written by Jan Uytenhofer, the Song of Solomon, based on 1 Kings 8, verse 56, and set to the tune of Genevan Psalm 129, the Christe qui lux est et dies, set to the tune of Genevan Psalm 100, another sung prayer for before the sermon, also set to the tune of Genevan Psalm 100. The only psalm to be translated into Malay and included in this collection in 1629 was Psalm 100. So you see the primacy of Psalm 100 here, right? The Dutch's insistence in teaching the people to sing these songs could also be seen through the way the Church Order of Batavia regulated the tasks of school teachers or schoolmasters, as they called them. So this is not just the task of the ministers, but this is also the task of the school teachers. In addition to teach the young people how to read and write and to catechize them, the school teachers must also teach the children to sing the psalms. Similarly, the comforter of the sick, the comforters of the sick were instructed to lead people at church in singing the psalms and to lead in prayers. At the hospitals, the comforters of the sick must also pray for the people, as well as reading passages from the Bible and leading the people in singing one or two verses of the psalms every day. Thus, we can see that the Dutch expanded their effort, as the Dutch expanded their effort to colonize the East Indies, they were also keen in bringing their religious practices, especially its singing tradition, into this newly conquered land. Even though the expansion into this new territory was done by the VOC, not by the Dutch Republic, so the VOC was a business enterprise, not the government. But there was a clear demonstration of an effort to rule over the people, not just in terms of the trading of spices, but also in terms of religion and religious beliefs. The Dutch were determined to transplant Reformed Protestantism in the lives of the indigenous people because it too will demonstrate their triumph over the people living in the archipelago. In addition, given the political tensions that the Dutch still had with Spain and Portugal in Europe in the early 17th century, the establishment of Reformed Protestantism in the East Indies also meant for the Dutch another victory over the Iberians, who had Roman Catholicism as their religion. Before the VOC was there, some parts of the archipelago had been in touch with Roman Catholicism, which was brought there by the Jesuits as the Portuguese and the Spaniards tried to monopolize the trading of spices in the first half of the 16th century. Between the years 1546 and 1547, Francis Xavier, came to the Moluccas Islands, the archipelago where the spices grew the best in all East Indies, to spread Roman Catholicism. While he was on the island of Ternate, one of the islands in the Moluccas Islands, Francis Xavier taught the young children the catechism. He translated the Ten Commandments, the Apostles' Creed, the Lord's Prayer, and the Ave Maria into Malay. He also set these texts into plain chants to help the children learn. In the Moluccas, Xavier baptized many people, and thus there was already a strong presence of Roman Catholicism before the Dutch came and defeated the Portuguese in the early decades of the 17th century. The people living in the archipelago also had their own singing tradition long before the Europeans arrived there. The Moluccans were well known for their traditional songs that were mostly accompanied by drums, called the tifa. François Caron, one of the most well-known Dutch preachers in the Moluccas in the 17th century, made a reference of the tifas, the drums that the Moluccans had, and their use in the singing tradition of the people in one of his sermons. Caron wanted to show that tifas, the drums, had a prominent place in the lives and the culture of the people of the Moluccans. In a different part of the archipelago, on the island of Java, the people had a very rich singing tradition of songs accompanied by the gamelan instruments as both teaching tools for spirituality and morality and also for entertainment. The Javanese songs called the tembang were mostly composed based on Javanese mysticism, which was a syncretic form of Islam and tribal Javanese religions. These are only two specific examples of the singing and musical traditions that the people in the East Indian archipelago already had prior to the arrival of the Dutch in their land. The Malay translation of the metrical psalm and the ecclesiastical songs, therefore, was an introduction of a new form of music and singing tradition that was foreign to the people. Against the backdrops of multitude of musical traditions and the different ethnic groups of the archipelago, and against the newer singing habits introduced by the Jesuits more than half a century before they arrived there, the Dutch must now impose their way of singing to the newly converted Reformed Protestants. Success on this front would bring twofold benefits for the Dutch. The first one would be regarding faith and religion in the form of the advancing of Reformed Protestantism. As Reformed believers, the Dutch believed that the Reformed faith was the only true faith. Any other religion would not bring true salvation. Thus, they wanted the indigenous people to embrace the Reformed faith. The second benefit would be political. The establishment of the new singing tradition that was thoroughly reformed and Dutch would mean that the Dutch's triumph over the Iberians, whose arrival in the archipelago gave way to the coming of the Jesuits and their effort to spread Roman Catholicism. Just as much as there was political rivalry between the Dutch and the Iberians in Europe, there was also bitter competitions between the European groups in the East Indies. The triumph would be made even stronger when the indigenous people followed the Dutch's way in worship, including singing these metrical psalms. Now, a closer look of some of the individual songs. The first song in the collection is the versified form of the Ten Commandments. The Dutch saw it fitting to place the Ten Commandments first in line because, of course, the Ten Commandments provide foundation for living as Christians. Now, I need to go back here. So this is the page where the Ten Commandments are printed. Now, before the song is printed, on top of both the Dutch on the left and the Malay translation on the right there is a short description about this song that says, Volgen eniges lofzangen, mit schaders andere gebeden, songswezen in onze christelijke kerke gebruikelijk. In English, roughly it means the following are praise songs and also some sung prayers that are ordinarily used in our church. This short description indicates that the singing of these songs is a part of the larger tradition of the Reformed Church, our church. Thus, this description stands right in the middle of Calvin's own concept of singing as praying. Like its Dutch origin, the Malay translation of the versified Ten Commandments has 11 stanzas. These stanzas follow very closely the verses of Exodus 20, where the Ten Commandments are written, but of course here it is written in a metrical format. The Song of Zechariah, the Benedictus, follows the Ten Commandments. Like in its Dutch origin, this song is set to the tune of Psalm 137. The short description of this song says that it is originally taken from the first chapter of the Gospel of Luke in its 68th verse. What is noteworthy regarding this short description is that at the time when the translation of the Gospel of Matthew was published in 1629, in which this collection of ecclesiastical songs were included, the Gospel of Luke had not been translated into Malay. Thus, this short description may serve as an early introduction of the unity of the scripture to the Malay-speaking people, even though they still do not have the complete Bible in their vernacular. In this translation, we see that there was some effort to contextualize the content of the Christian message using the vocabulary and names that are common to the people already. The hymn translated, for instance, the names of David and Abraham into the Arabic names Dawood and Ibrahim. Because the people were already familiar with the names, Islam was already there about 300 years before the Europeans came. Similarly, we also see the use of Arabic name Mariam for Mary in the translation of the Magnificat. Even though these are names used in the Quran, the translator was not hesitated to adopt these names into the songs. The people were already familiar with these names, and therefore there was no need to enforce the use of the Dutch versions of these biblical names. Similarly, we also see the adoption of God's name Allah into the songs, as well as in the rest of the Gospel of Matthew and other printed materials published during this era. The Dutch recognized that the Malay language does not have its own word for God. The Malay-speaking people living in the archipelago had been using the Arabic name Allah that was commonly done by the Muslims, as explained by Sebastian Dankarts, a Dutch minister serving in the East Indies in the 1620s in his Dutch Malay Dutch dictionary. So this is a shot of the actual dictionary from 1623 that Dankart published. Now you can see that the Dutch name Hot is translated as Allah or Allah Ta'ala. And then the description says a Portuguese word Deus is zeer gebruikelijk onder de Malaysian Christenen. that God is. So the Portuguese word Deus has been used by the Malay-speaking Christians who were familiar with Roman Catholicism. What is interesting to see here is that the Dutch, even though they recognized that the Portuguese name of God, Deus, was already used by some of the Malay-speaking Christians in the archipelago, they didn't choose to use Deus. However, they still chose to use the Arabic name Allah for the Malay translation of the songs. They preferred to adopt the name of God that came from Islam instead of taking the word from their enemy, the Portuguese. Another important word that was adopted from Arabic was that related to holiness. In the translation of the Magnificat, the translator adopted the word Ul-Qadus to refer to the holy name of God. This is consistent with the translation of the rest of the Gospel of Matthew, in which the name Holy Spirit is translated as Ruah Ul-Qadus. The Arabic word Qadus or Kudus means holy. The Arabic word Ruh or Ruah means spirit. The use of its derivation, Rouhani, was widely used to refer to the spirits of human or human spirituality. Thus, it was natural that in verse 6 of the Magnificat, the Malay translation of the song uses the word Rouhani to show that God satisfies those who are poor in spirit. Another use of the word Ruh to refer to the Spirit of God is found in the translation of the Apostles' Creed. In the first stanza, where Jesus is said to have been conceived by the Holy Spirit, in the song, the Malay translation calls the Holy Spirit Roh Allah, the Spirit of Allah. The name of Christ has no parallel in the Malay language. The entire collection of the songs, therefore, keeps the Dutch word Christus, or sometimes Christ for short, in order to maintain continuity with the use of the name Christus or Christ. This is found almost everywhere in the collection, but most clearly seen in the translation of the Lord's Prayer. The choice of variation between Christus, the longer, or Christ, the shorter name, seemed to be determined by the need to fit the name into the sentence and the meter. In trying to keep the meter exactly the same as the original tunes out of which the songs are translated, the translator needed to make a decision whether the name Christus will be used or just the shorter name Christ in order to fit the message into the metrical formula of each song. In keeping with the poetical nature of the metrical songs, the Malay translations of these pieces closely follow the rhyme patterns of the original Dutch songs. So when the original Dutch piece has a rhyme of AABB, for instance, the Malay translation of the same piece would also made to fit the same rhyme. This would sometimes end up with sentences whose word orders are in verse because the translators seem to put the primacy of rhyme over sentence structure. Even though this technique is common in poetry reading throughout the world, for the Malay-speaking people, these sentence structures may sound unnatural or even forced. An interesting example can be seen in the last line of stanza 6 of the Lord's Prayer, in which the Malay translation of this line says, "Dengan kekasihan maha," meaning with an abundant love. Linguistically, the placement of the word maha in the last position of the sentence is uncommon in the Malay language. The word maha, meaning exceedingly great, is originally from Sanskrit. In both Sanskrit and Malay, the word must precede the word it modifies. In this example, it modifies the word kekasihan, or love. However, because the last sentence in this stanza must rhyme with the preceding line that ends with the sound a, then the translator took the liberty of inversing maha and a kekasihan to achieve the desired rhyme. Now, the translation of the translation and the inclusion of Christe qui lux est et dies in this collection is unique, because it shows some measure to maintain continuity with the medieval tradition while combining it with the Reformed tradition. In its history, the text of the hymn was traceable to two different groups. One was the so-called West German group, and the other one was the Salzburg Monks group. The Dutch text of the hymn followed the tradition of the 15th century West German group. Dorothy Lyon explained that the West German group of the hymn is characterized by its rhyme of AABB, whereas the Salzburg monks group had the rhyme scheme of ABAB. The Malay translation of the hymn, therefore, also has the rhyme AABB. The use of the Genevan tune of Psalm 100 with its 8888 meter made possible the translation in an iambic tetrameter, the meter that is characteristic of the West German group of the hymn. The Dutch version of the hymn came from the translation of the Genevan Psalms made by Peter Dathen in 1567. Peter Dathen was a Flandrian monk who became Reformed preacher and actively preached to the Dutch refugees in Germany. He was very supportive of the tradition of psalm singing following the practice of the Reformed Church in Geneva. Dathen translated the Genevan Psalms of Clement Marot in a relatively short time. Even though the translation was criticized as being rough and poetically unappealing as an evidence of hasty translation, the Psalter gained popularity in the Netherlands. The Psalter was fully endorsed by the Synod at Wesel in 1568 and then re-endorsed by the Synod of Dort in 1578. With this re-endorsement in Dort in 1578, Dathen Psalmody became the authorized version for the Dutch Reformed Church, even though there were other versions of the Psalter, most notably by Jan Uytenhofer and also by Philip van Marnix. Dathen Psalter included 7 ecclesiastical songs, and one of the songs was the Christe qui lux est et dies. There was a speculation that the hymn might have only been used for private singing at home and not to be sung during worship services at church, considering that this is an evening hymn. But the speculation is often dismissed by many scholars. Now, the inclusion of the Christe in Dathen's Psalter was curious. Why would Dathen, a strong proponent of Calvin's Reformed practices, include the medieval hymn in his collection? A possible explanation was that Dathen, as I already said, used to be a monk. In the Netherlands, after the Reformation, a good number of Roman Catholics became Reformed believers, including priests and monks. According to Randy Engel, these priests, even though thoroughly immersed in their newly adopted Reformed theology, they were still used to chanting the liturgy, supported by skilled organists. Furthermore, Engel notes that these ex-Catholics, together with their congregations and their ministers, never challenged the use of organs in the church. This could very well explain why Dathen included the Christe in his Psalter. It was a part of Dathen's past, and a certain group of ex-Catholics turning Reformed members of the church cherished the tradition as well. Further into the 17th century, in the Reformed churches in the Netherlands, organ music was used as pedagogical tool to introduce Genevan psalm tunes to the congregation. Even though the Reformed churches in the Netherlands only sang the Genevan psalm during services without accompaniment, the organist would play some melodies before the service, including the melody of the Ten Commandments and also one of the Genevan tunes to be sung at the service. Before the evening prayers, the church organist would usually play a psalm tune, followed by, guess what, Christe qui lux est et dies. The famous Dutch organist Jan Sweelinck included the Christe in his repertoire. Thus, we can see that the hymn had a prominent place in the worshiping experience of the Dutch people in the Netherlands in the 16th and early 17th century. It is not surprising, therefore, that in the East Indies, this hymn was translated into Malay. The choice of the use of the tune of Genevan Psalm 100 for the Malay translation of the hymn is another interesting fact. As I already mentioned, the small collection of the songs in Malay only included one Genevan Psalm, Psalm 100. And in the collection, the same tune was also used for 2 versified prayers before the sermon. The tune of Psalm 100 seemed to be one of the most famous ones in the Netherlands. It is one of the tunes to be included in the first published organ pieces intended for postludes after church services, which was the work of Hendrik Joosten Spuy. Spuy was the documented organist of the National Synod of Dort in 1618. Spuy published his collection called the Salmen Davids, gesteld op het tabulatuur van het orgel en klaversimmel met 2 partien in 1610. According to, again, Randy Engel, the work was considered monumental because it was the first published work on organ music from a Reformed church by a Reformed organist to be used in the Reformed church. The fame and familiarity of Psalm 100 might have been the reason why the tune was chosen to be the tune for Christe Quilux es et dies in Dutch. So now this is the Dutch and the Malay translations of the Christe to give you a little bit of a flavor of how it was sung in Malay. I'll try to sing it. Kristus jadi pun hari terang, tiadanya tutup barang. Cahaya Bapa-Ku berhidup, ajar kita jalan hidup. So that's Psalm 100 and the text of Christe first stanza. Like the original Latin version of the Christe, the Dutch and the Malay versions also have 7 verses. The first point to notice in the Malay translation is the shift in grammatical structure in the target language to fit the sentences into the meter. In the first line of the first stanza, the Malay hymn is missing the relative pronoun who or qui in Latin. The first line in Malay thus becomes Christ becomes the light of day, instead of Christ who is light and day. Another example of the missing relative pronoun is found in the third line of stanza 6. Instead of being translated as the soul which you have redeemed, the relative pronoun there, which is missing, in Malay the sentence became, when your soul is departed. So here we see a switch from the Dutch text to the Malay translation, where a relative clause that explains the state of the soul which is redeemed is now translated as a different relative clause that talks about the death of the soul. Again, to fit this, the meter and the rhyme. The translation of this line from redeemed to departed also shows how change was deliberately done in order to fit the sentence into the rhyme. The translation seems to ignore the important theological meaning of redemption of the soul for the sake of fitting the stanza into an AABB rhyme scheme. The result is that this line now talks about the soul being departed or dead instead of being redeemed. Even though the overall meaning of stanza 6 of the Malay translation still retains the idea of Jesus giving peace, the third line is missing the important concept of redemption. Shifts also happen in the mood of some of the sentences and the overall mood of the hymn. Generally, the imperative mood that functions as a request in the original hymn is changed into an indicative mood. This shift is already found in verse 1. In the Dutch text, and also in the Latin text, the last line of stanza 1 reads as an imperative mood in which the one singing asks God, teach us the way and the truth. In the Malay translation, the sentence becomes a positive or declarative sentence in which the singer proclaims that God the Father is the one teaching us the way to live. This shift is consistent throughout the hymn. While the Dutch text continues to show that this hymn is a prayer, the Malay counterpart becomes more declarative to tell the people of who God really is and what God does. So that's a shift, all right? And now, the last one that I'm going to talk here is the apocryphal Psalm 151. You were probably already puzzled by this. So the apocryphal Psalm 151 included in this collection is also worth our attention. Both the Dutch and Malay texts of the song called this song an apocryphal psalm. The Dutch title, however, also adds a descriptive phrase Egreko to signify that this psalm was originally from Greek. Both the Dutch and Malay texts have a short description after the title that says in English, roughly meaning, this psalm is one piece of writing of King David, which is included in the Greek Bible, even though the psalm is outside of the 150 psalms. This psalm tells the story of David who defeated Goliath after he has been anointed by God to be a king. This introduction clearly shows that the Dutch were aware that this psalm is not part of the Protestant Bible. In the Septuagint, this psalm directly follows the text of Psalm 150. Historically, we know that the text of this psalm is a part of the Syriac manuscripts. With the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we now know that the text of this psalm came from two distinct psalms, commonly called Psalm 151a and 151b, which are parts of the collection in 11 QPS. In this collection of the Dead Sea Scrolls Psalm, Psalm 151a has the longer text that outlines the events of David's life as written in 1 Samuel 16, 1 to 13. This text forms the larger part of the Septuagint Psalm 151. The Dead Sea Scrolls Psalm 151b is a shorter text that tells the story of David's defeat of Goliath. The Septuagint condensed the two texts and included them just into one psalm, Psalm 151a, written into verses 1 to 5, and Psalm 151b into verses 6 and 7. Following the Septuagint, the Dutch versified version of the psalm, and therefore the Malay translation of it, is written in three stanzas. The meter of the song is 667-667 double. While the story of this psalm is obviously biblical, we are left to wonder of the reason of the inclusion of this song in the Dutch Psalter, which was then translated into Malay. One possible and rather obvious explanation might rest in the fact that this is a song about David. Even though the text of the psalm is only found in the Septuagint and not part of the canon that is accepted by the Protestant Church, the Dutch Reformed Church did not have any hesitance in including this psalm in their singing tradition. If the church were to sing the 150 psalms, which were commonly attributed to David, what difference would it make to include one more psalm that directly talks about David, the author of the psalms? The Dutch did not see any problem in including this psalm in the collection, perhaps for the same reason they did not object to the inclusion of the hymn Christe qui lux est et dies. Another possible explanation I can think of for the inclusion of this psalm in the collection may have to do with the text of the psalm itself. The last three lines of the first stanza of the Dutch version of the psalm says, in Dutch, an instrument ik racht, daarop ik dan voorbracht, des Allerhoogstens ere. In English, roughly meaning, an instrument I fashioned, and then I sang praise to the highest Lord. Could these three lines be used an extra support for the use of musical instrument in the Dutch Reformed Church? The Greek text in the Septuagint uses the word organon, organ, for the instrument. While the Dutch text did not downright use the word organ in this psalm, could there be a hidden message being fleshed out through this psalm to justify the use of the organ in the church? Even though the battle over the use of musical instrument in the church was not an issue in the East Indies, the Malay translation of this psalm added to the richness and complexity of the transplantation of Reformed Church and its singing tradition. Without realizing it, the newly converted Reformed believers in the archipelago were led into a tradition that was completely foreign to them. Together with the theology and ecclesial practices of the church, these new Protestants in the archipelago are also learned a new way of worshiping that included singing these songs. Over the next century or so, the work to translate the metrical psalms into Malay continued. The singing of the metrical psalms and ecclesiastical songs became an integral experience of the Reformed Protestants in the East Indies. This translation work moved along almost parallel with the translation of the whole Bible into Malay, which culminated in 1733, when Lydekker's Bible was eventually published in Malay. A couple of years later, all the 150 metrical psalms in Malay were published by Georg Henrik Werentley in 1735. With the translation of the entire Psalms into Malay, the tradition of singing of the Psalms in the worship services continued into the next centuries. Now, in conclusion, this study shows that the Dutch's dedication to the Reformed faith became a very strong motivation to transplant its theology and ecclesial practices in the East Indies, including the tradition of singing the metrical psalms and ecclesiastical songs. This effort, however, was wrapped in the larger context of colonialization. And thus, we can also see that the work to bring Reformed Protestantism to the people was also politically motivated. The ministers and other church workers sent to the archipelago worked for the VOC. Therefore, they had to obey the commands of the VOC. Seen in this context, then, we could say that the Dutch's success in transplanting the Reformed tradition in the land was another measure of success of the Dutch in subjecting the indigenous people under their power. When these people worshipped and sang the way the Dutch did, they were easier to control. The placement of the Ten Commandments as first in the list of ecclesiastical songs in the collection may have also been motivated by this effort. Well, it is certainly true that the versified version of the Ten Commandments was also sung in Calvin's Geneva. The Ten Commandments also contains the command to honor one's father and one's mother. In the tradition of Reformed churches, this commandment is interpreted also to include honoring and obedience to one's superiors, be it at home, in the church, at workplace, etc. The Dutch had come to have the authority to rule the indigenous people. Therefore, when the newly Christians in the archipelago are called to obey God, they must also obey the Dutch, their new authority figures. The collection of these songs also shows some departure from the tradition of the Reformed Church in Geneva at the time of Calvin. As I already shown, the inclusion of the two hymns, Christe qui lux esse dies and the apocryphal Psalm of David, was a prime example. As the Dutch Reformed Church formed its own tradition within the larger context of Reformed Protestantism, it allowed certain elements that were not parts of the Reformed Church in Geneva to be included in their worshiping experience. Then, when the Dutch transplanted their ecclesial tradition in the East Indies, these elements were also carried along. And more interesting yet, when these hymns were translated into Malay, there were further shifts that we can see linguistically and culturally. Thus, this little study provides us with a close look into the richness of the Reformed tradition as it became more global. Thank you.
Degree was in linguistics. Does it tell you something? Yeah, this man knows what he's talking about. The points of language, I think, are particularly interesting, Yuda. And we'll have a time for questions. And I'd like to start out, if I can. Obviously, the translators were Dutch.
Yes.
Do you think that explains, to a large extent, the linguistic problems? In other words, if it had been someone who spoke Malay, that was their home language,
yes,
the result would have been different.
Yes, thank you. A very good question, Karine. Yes, the translators were Dutch. However, they studied, and there are evidences that they studied the classical style of Malay. The very first Dutch Malay-Dutch dictionary was already published in 1603. So if you see the history, the VOC was established in 1602. The Dutch arrived in the East Indies in 1596. The VOC was started in 1602. The very first book that the VOC published was the dictionary. So they were studying the language very, very seriously for both the political and the commercial purposes. So yes, the result would have been different, but of course the question of who could do that in Malay, and especially you need to look at the source text and knowledge of the source text in order to be able to translate that into the target text or target language. Yes, but to their defense, if I may, is that they studied the classical Malay, and this was the result of classical Malay learning that they had.
Okay, thank you. Other questions, point people want to make? Yes, Don. Yeah.
You emphasized that the translations into Malay were put in metrical structure. In earlier Malay poetry and songs, was the metrical structure ever used?
Yes, in many parts. In many parts of Indonesia, poetry writing was already established there. So Malay poetries were already common. Again, the texts that the Dutch translators studied were mostly poetical. So yes, many ethnic groups in the archipelago already had these poetical traditions, the singing traditions. The Javanese people with their singing tradition, both are all poetical and metrical. I know a lot about the Javanese music and songs, and they are guided by rules, you know, how many lines, just like what we know about meter in the Western world. The Javanese songs are also governed by that. So each type of song is governed by how many lines per stanza, how many syllables per line. So that kind of singing tradition had already been a part of the people in the archipelago.
But the Western structure, the European metrical structure, was probably different than...
Yes, exactly that. Yes, exactly that. That's why I said that the Dutch still imposed on the people of what they want the people to do and sing. And so the inclusion of traditional songs into the worshiping experience of the Protestants in the country only came at the last end of the 20th century. So if I can expand this, my own experience was that when I was growing up, I grew up singing these songs, both the psalms and the hymns. And to me, anything that's traditional, especially from the Javanese background, it's a no-no because they are rooted in the mysticism, the syncretistic religion of Islam and other Javanese religions that are already there. And so my upbringing was... prevented me from singing these songs. So it was hard for the Protestants in the country to embrace what was what is the tradition of the people because the Dutch imposed on that kind of a strict rule in singing. Only what the Europeans did was the only thing and the true thing. So
other questions, things people want to ask about? David. Yes, David.
Was there any tradition of group singing or congregational singing in Islam in Indonesia? My impression is that in general, Islam doesn't emphasize communal singing very much at all. But was that a tradition in Indonesia?
No. Historically and traditionally, there's none. Only in the later part of the 20th century that they started singing their religious songs in some kind of combined style of Arabic and some Indonesian tradition songs. But that was not.
That refers to some of the Indonesian epics and those recitals. Those would have been sung.
Yes, they were all sung, yes.
But Islam didn't adopt those.
No, that was still the domain of the indigenous people. I was talking about the Java, especially in central Java, with the use of gamelan music and the singing tradition. That was very specific, and it was not claimed as Islam, even though the teaching behind that has some Islamic touches and influences, but that is traditional Javanese, not Islam.
So what you have since the beginning of the 17th century is the persistence of all these traditional musical forms, and the persistence of the Western.
Yes.
Side by side.
Parallel. Completely separate. Yes. Yes. Laura.
Other questions? Yeah, Laura, go ahead. So contemporary mission people often talk about how Christianity is a translated religion at its heart, right? But our gospel is probably not the language Jesus spoke, so from the beginning it's translated. Wherever Christianity goes, it's translated. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like you're saying this translation wasn't a very smooth one, or a very good one.
Yes.
So, can you imagine what it might have looked like if they translated a little more authentically? I mean, has this been a barrier, do you think, to the growth of the church in Indonesia?
That could be, yes. Yes. Because, again, this was all imposed by the Dutch. And that's what they knew the best to do in the 16th and 17th century, 18th centuries. It was a barrier, yes, because there are some people living in the rural areas in Indonesia that are still repelled to the idea of Christianity. Among other things, is because Christianity is the religion of the colonizers, right? The religion of the enemy. So why should I embrace the religion of the enemy? Yeah.
So the church in Indonesia today, is there a missional effort to kind of retranslate and translate?
Yes, of course. Yeah, between 17th century and even the 20th century, there were a lot of efforts already. And what I presented here is only the beginning when Protestantism was brought to the country. But then later, there were more efforts. The mission. So you can see that in the 17th and 18th centuries, they were all done by the VOC, everything controlled by the VOC. By the 19th century, many of the agencies, the mission agencies, were formed. And so the missionaries are more attentive to the needs of the people, and they are more spread out, not just in Java or in Ambon, but all throughout Indonesia, and the missionaries listened more. But even so, there are still tensions here and there. In Java, later I've done a research on Java and the singing tradition also, there was a split between the missionaries who allowed the Javanese to still wear their traditional garb, and to let the men to have long hair, for instance. But there are other Dutch missionaries that say, no, if you want to become Christian, you cut your hair, you wear shirt and trousers the way the Europeans do. That's what leaving your old religion behind. So even among themselves, there were some controversies. Yes, Chad. Yeah.
So Malay, at this time, was it a written language? And why did the Dutch then, like if it was, did they not decide to use their script?
Yes. Good question. Now, Malay was already written language. Now, before the Dutch came, before the Portuguese came, Malay was in a unique situation because the language is Malay, but the written form is Arabic. Because remember, Islam was already there 300 years before. So it's called the Jawi script. The Jawi script is Arabic script, but sounds Malay. Right, those are the texts that the ministers learned. The translators learned Malay. But you could also see that the Dutch wanted all done in vernacular, the teaching, because that's what the people knew. However, this is also very interesting because that's a subject of a different paper. Is that even in Malay itself, there's the high Malay, the Malay of the cultured and the educated, and also the low Malay. The people spoke low Malay. The Dutch translated this in high Malay. And even that alone is a huge controversy. You know, in the later 17th, early 18th centuries, there were the so which version of the Bible, you know, do you pick? There were two parallel. I mentioned the Leidecker Bible that was finally published in 1733. It was high Malay. But Leidecker's effort was dampened by somebody named Francois Valentine, who wanted to publish the Bible in low Malay. You see, so even that is very very complicated. Yeah.
Any other questions? Yeah, I wanted to come back. And first of all, let me say how much I enjoyed this.
Thank you. Really, thank you.
And I want to come back to this issue that Laura raised about the authenticity of the text.
Yeah.
And I can understand that you find sort of infelicitous grammar slightly jarring. Mm-hmm. But aren't you being a little curlish when you want an exact translation as opposed to a poetic or lyrical translation?
Yes.
Clement Mahol writes these wonderfully poetic, we'll call them psalms. They're not translations. I mean, he creates whole new stanzas
yes.
that don't exist in scripture.
Yes, yes.
But it works wonderfully well.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that Calvin objected to it.
Mm-hmm.
So if we change the meaning slightly from the Dutch text to a Malay text, are we really committing a great sin here?
Thank you, Ray. Yes. Thank you. Well, I don't see it as a great sin. No, but by no means, I don't mean to say that. And in fact, even when I was talking about the translation of Christe, I highlighted the fact that the meaning shifted, but of that line, of that stanza. But the overall teaching of the song, if I may say, did not change. Right. So the Reformed faith. Is still there. The Reformed teaching is still there, but wrapped in a different wording, different kind of explanation. So, no, it's not a great sin for sure. And for centuries they kept singing it. And of course, you know, when we look at this, the Dutch ministers who went to the East Indies really worked very hard to keep the orthodoxy of their teaching. right? So this translation would not have passed their scrutiny if they were not satisfied with the overall meaning. So yeah, I was just showing that, especially what I found in the Christi is that some of the sentences are changed, and that the mood of prayer, right? I mean, you know, the imperative mood was changed into declarative, and so. It's what I'm trying to show is that it's not exactly the same as the source text, but still, this is a long debate and long discussion in translation theory too, right? So how much you translate, because a translation in a certain measure also includes interpretation. So the translator must interpret and the way they understand the piece. So that would be my comment. Thank you.
All right, let's have a question. Yeah. Philip?
Yes, the psalter itself is bilingual.
Yes.
So how do they sing in the church?
Good question. Yes. They had Dutch services and Malay services separate. So Dutch services at 10 and Malay services at 2 p.m. In Batavia, in Ambon, in some other places. So this is also back to Chet's earlier question, you know. So there is the emphasis of the use of the vernacular in order for the common people to understand. So even though I highlighted the fact that there was the high Malay, low Malay, eventually they use all high Malay as the standard form. So there are separate congregations, the Dutch speaking. Well, actually, there are three: the Dutch speaking, the Malay speaking, and also the Portuguese speaking. Because there were a lot of ex-Catholic Portuguese speaking people becoming Reformed also. And if you read the Church Order of Batavia, they have regulation for all three: for the Dutch, for the Malay, and the Portuguese speaking congregations. Yes. Yes, yes. Hence, all those logos. When you see the publications by the VOC, either you see the V and O and the C or the ship. They all picked up
so
the bill.
But this is largely from the VOC.
Yes.
From the church.
No. No, that's why I said that, you know, it's all done by the VOC, it's imposed by the VOC. All the church workers must submit themselves under the VOC.
In other words, you know, keeping the peace in the trading post rather than evangelizing.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's for the ministers, it's to keep the balance between teaching theology and satisfying the masters.
Exactly.
All right, I think we will now thank our speaker for his presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wednesday, November 4, we have our next lecture. It's going to be given by a professor from Eastern Oregon University, Greg Monahan, and he's speaking on the Camisards, who were a group in the French church, the French Reformed Church, and his title is Calvinist Terrorists, ? Because these Camisards were essentially freedom fighters for French Protestantism in Catholic France. So if you want to find out more, Wednesday, November 4 at 3:30 in here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. I hope it's okay.
Thank you for your help.
Yes.
Oh, you're welcome.